This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
If this jury finds Lindsay Clancy not criminally responsible, she does not walk free. Contrary to popular belief, she's not going to be like, where are you going next? Disneyland. That's not what's going to happen. Massachusetts law sends her basically back where she's been, psychiatric facility for observation and long-term commitment. She's already been at Tewksbury State Hospital for more than 3 years. The question isn't whether she'd be released. It's what happens next inside that system. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us. And Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. So under Massachusetts law, the court can order a 40-day observation period after an insanity verdict. And the DA can petition for 6 months, then another 6 months. Andrea Yates was found not guilty by reason of insanity in 2006, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. She's still in a state facility 20 years later. Is commitment a shorter road or a longer one here, Siobhan? And how would this play out? Is it constantly a renewal every 6 months on the part of the state? Or explain to the audience what would happen here.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because this was one of my jobs in my forensic history, where I was one of the people that went in every 6 months to do evaluations. How is this person doing in the facility? What kind of progress are they making? Are they deteriorating? Are they taking medication? Are they still symptomatic? Are they aggressive? I mean, it was a really comprehensive evaluation. And I worked for the state of California, and we had a team in our county, and it went county by county. So everybody that was in an institution like this who had committed a crime, it was a locked facility, and from what I hear about Tewksbury, the prisons, or I call them the forensic prisons, right? It was for the mentally ill folks who had committed crimes. Not a terribly pleasant place, not what we think of as a private mental health facility at all. Quite prison-like in many ways, but there was more treatment going on than you would get in a prison. But that was one of the things. When we had people that were released, they went into our program, the conditional release program, where they were very closely monitored. There was a team of therapists. We each had no more than 7 people that we closely monitored. We had daily contact with some, depending on how they were doing. Otherwise, it was, you know, weekly individual therapy, weekly group therapy, sometimes 2 groups a week. They were drug tested. We went out and did surprise home inspections. I mean, it was really closely monitored to make sure that they were safe in the community, because the number one criteria for being out after you've been in a situation like this is safety of the community. Now, some of those people had been in that program for 20 and 30 years, where they were living in the community, but we were monitoring them. But the other piece of that job, I was the person, and I wasn't the only one, it was everyone on the team that had a group that we followed that were still in the institution. And we would go in every 6 months, that was the law, and we would do a full evaluation of how they were doing in the institution. And we would go through every record, we would have an interview with them. If they had had recent psych testing, we would go over the results of that. And then we could make a recommendation to the court: this person is doing so well. They're no longer symptomatic. They have insight into their condition. And we would write all that up, document it. It was copious records that we kept. And then it went back to the team, and it was, this person is looking terrific. They've made so much progress. We believe they could, you know, go into the conditional release program, and they would have a shot at life outside. Now, that could be 10 years later, it could be 20 years later, or it could be never. And there were many, many people who were never going to be well enough to get out. So it could, in essence, be a life sentence. And very seldom, in fact, I can't think of one that I went in and interviewed and recommended that this person should be looked at closer for possible release. So it's rare. It's rare to get out, and it does happen. Some people make tremendous progress and do have a recommendation to get out, but it's not common.
And so some great points there, Siobhan, and I apologize for my mic falling a second ago, everyone. So as I understand it from you, so you're the psych team inside the prison at the mental health prison. They make their recommendations to the court, but still it's ultimately the judge and the court that decide whether they're released or not. Then based upon, I'm guessing, the totality of what actually that crime was. In other words, if you had the judge and you, even if you and your team make that recommendation that we think she's fit to reenter society, the judge could still say, yes. Nope, no. Killed three kids, never.
Yeah. Never. Yeah. Or we're going to reevaluate every 6 months for the rest of their stay.
Right.
It's going to be an every 6 month evaluation.
Right.
And I didn't actually work in the facility. I worked outside of the facility, but I would go into the different state hospitals across the state every 6 months and go over all the staff records, any testing that had been done, their behavior. And they had treatment goals in the facility. How were they doing with their treatment goals? I knew, just to toss out an example, one guy was never going to get out. His treatment plan in the facility, he was so low functioning, was he will stop drinking out of the toilet and stop stabbing the other inmates in the lunch line with pencils. And okay, this guy was never going to get out. You know, this is not a person who's going to improve. And there were a lot of folks like that. So people who had committed certain kinds of horrendous sex offenders, they were not going to get out because they were just never going to be considered safe to be in the community.
Let me throw some of the things your way that I know some of the audience is thinking, and you can answer it. What if she fakes her way out? What if she finds a way to fool all the doctors, Siobhan?
I personally have not seen that happen. And again, we get into, is this a psychotic person or is this a psychopathic person?
Yeah.
And when we look at people who do that, who in prison go before the parole board and come up with this elaborate story about how they've changed and progressed, that's psychopathic. And when you're dealing with folks with severe mental illness, it just doesn't really go that way. So I'm very skeptical of that happening.
Does she have a choice? I mean, Andrea Yates is still in a facility. And I know I have read that she doesn't want to leave. I don't know the predicate before that of how that all functions. So I'm asking you, is it up to her? Is it up to Lindsay? I mean, if she is deemed okay to release into society outside of the facility, who ultimately makes that call? And if the facility says, you're good to go, but she's like, I'm happy here.
Yeah.
Does she have a say?
Excellent. Excellent question. And the only people who would be considered good to go would be people who are eager to go and have a very clear life plan. How am I going to make sure that I stay on my medication? How am I going to make sure that I don't have a relapse with my condition? What would be the signs of having a relapse? How would I have support? So it has to be people who are doing really well and really motivated to get out. And if they didn't want to get out, if they felt safer in the institution, that would be a person that would stay there.
Yeah, and Tony, straight on right. I didn't realize that. I knew she's still behind bars in the mental health institutes, but yeah, Andrea Yates consistently has chosen to stay review after review after review. Yeah.
So this could be a situation where, as with Lindsay Clancy, she tried to get into some help to another facility, and then they're like, we don't qualify. Here, she could stay if she wanted to, because all she had to do was kill her kids first to finally get the help that she needs. It's horrible. I mean, it's insane. But this is how we work. Once you do something really horrible, then we'll take you seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does it look like? Because I know everybody's thinking about all these possibilities. Here, run me down this scenario. Riddle me this. She's in the institution for a while, 5, 10 years, whatever, a period of time. She is released. She gets out into society. And everyone's fear, you know, that everyone's throwing out there online is, what if she has another baby? What if she bamboozles someone and they run off together and then she has... So let's just run through that. What if she does? What if she does go have a baby? What if she gets out and there's some relapsing or unhealthy behavior? Not necessarily criminal, not necessarily killing people, but just you're off your meds and we can tell you're not doing well. What sort of levers does the mental health apparatus have to go back and say, yeah, we got to bring you back here? Yeah, if anything, if no crimes have been committed.
Yeah, no, this is one of the things about monitoring folks outpatient if they were deemed safe to be outpatient. There's something called the terms and conditions of release. So it's conditional release. You're only released as long as you follow to the very strict rule, the terms and conditions. For people that have a drug history, they're tested weekly or randomly tested for drugs. And if they have let's say they test dirty for THC, immediately back. And we had the right as clinicians to make an immediate call to the police and say, immediately come pick this up and put them back in the hospital. And I would think a term and condition for her would be you don't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And if you got pregnant, you would probably immediately go back in the hospital and the child would be placed somewhere. I think that would be, that would be watched very closely.
Is that indefinite? Like forever?
So it's a case by case basis. You know, has somebody, let's say somebody committed a fairly minor crime, because some of the folks had committed minor crimes, but they did it when they were mentally ill. Like one guy was schizophrenic and he decided one day to hijack the city bus around town and he pulled out a butter knife and waved a butter knife around. That got him in the state hospital. He was eventually determined to have insight. He was on medication. You know, the crime had not hurt anybody. I mean, it was almost a rather silly kind of crime, but it was taken seriously. And he followed terms and conditions. But if there was anything at all that indicated he was not taking his meds, he was threatening anybody, he had paranoid thinking, anything like that, he would immediately go back in. So my guess is her terms and conditions would be very strict. And she would be monitored, possibly monitored for the rest of her life.
Here's an interesting stat on that, too. As we brought up the possibility of her getting out and giving birth again, remember, we have this little thing called menopause. And given her current age,
not there yet.
Well, she's got about, so if you're looking roughly, it's 15 years based on average age and anywhere between 9 and 19 years. If she's in cars already beyond that, it wouldn't be an issue anyway.
A lot of people's
everything.
No, I mean, I get it. I mean, there's that, but she's not there yet. I mean, there's very real possibility that, you know, that could take place. Three defense experts diagnosed Lindsay with bipolar disorder, Tewksbury State Hospital, where she's been held for 3 years under one-to-one supervision, diagnosed her with bipolar. The prosecution's own expert, Kirk Helburn, took the stand and agreed bipolar type 2. The only person in the entire trial who disagreed was Avram Mack, who called it major depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. Helburn was supposed to be there to help the prosecution. Instead, he's confirmed the defense's diagnosis and handed them the argument that this was altruistic filicide, that she killed them out of love. That's the prosecution's own witness saying that, which to me sounds like a qualifying event to be found not guilty by reason of insanity.
It actually is.
She's currently on Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic. I know all this because Siobhan corrected one of my questions when I sent it to her yesterday.
We've got such education on all this.
Yes. Great. So when the prosecution's own expert agrees with the defense on the diagnosis, what's the jury supposed to do with that?
And we actually had more. We had, I made the list, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Donald Condi went over all the records going back from the beginning of her treatment. serious possibility that has to be considered was bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Paul Zeisel, bipolar disorder with postpartum psychosis. Now, this is an interesting one. Dr. Margaret Spinelli, who is considered one of the world's best forensic reproductive psychiatrists. And she evaluated her, but ultimately did not testify. And we do not know, we've not been told why she didn't testify. But her diagnosis, bipolar 1 disorder with postpartum psychosis, the jury will have access to that report. Philip Resnick, bipolar 2 disorder, severe depressive episode with postpartum psychosis at the time of the killing. Dr. Kirk Heilbrum for the prosecution, bipolar disorder, but rejected psychosis at the time of the killing. And then, of course, I think probably the worst witness was Dr. Mack, who went with major depressive disorder. But the other thing about that, you know, didn't come out at trial that I think is very relevant, you can have in severe major depressive disorder psychotic features. And that does not rule out that even if you went with just his diagnosis, which nobody else agreed with, she could have been psychotic from that.
So it all could happen under any of them. Yeah.
And the SI ideation from the massive depression and then the filicide, altruistic filicide, whether it's that as presented by one of the clinicians for the prosecution in there, or the other very similar diagnosis of the psychotic break all these terms, the psychotic break basically as the explanation as well. Both are qualifying for guilty by reason of insanity. So either or, and that's what they're all agreeing on, which is you made some great points, Jevon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's the issue?
Exactly. Like, why are we here? This could have been all handled. She said early on, you know, lock me away forever. And they were like, nope, we want to do this dog and pony show first. Let me ask you one quick question on this before we start talking more about all the Patrick stuff. Is there ever situations, and maybe this is a state by state thing, where someone, you know, is found guilty, goes to the prison system, and the prison system goes, this person needs a mental health hospital. They should not be in this. There's nothing we can do here that is going to keep, like, it's a liability to us. Not that they really care all that much, because people die all the times in prison. Mm-hmm. But do they make that call sometimes going, this is a mental hospital person, not a prison?
Okay. Very much that they can't be managed in prison, because prisons do employ psychiatrists.
Yeah.
Now, they don't do the kind of treatment that you would get in a place like Tewksbury, but they do monitor folks. And yes, they can make a recommendation that we need to have a hearing and get this person over into a forensic mental health facility because they're, you know, it's just not appropriate in prison. So that does happen. And the one thing that I wanted to just say a little bit about, because I think the general public is very confused. We heard a lot of references to the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And it's commonly referred to, which is completely inaccurate, as the Bible of mental health professionals. It is not the Bible. It's an evolving classification system based upon the best available evidence at the time and the clinical consistency at the time. But symptoms overlap. A lot of it is fuzzy. It is constantly changing. We get revisions every few years because teams and committees go in and take a section. They review, what's the current literature? There's been new studies done. We look at it a bit differently now. And so it's changing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, the DSM is published by the American Psychiatric Association. The rest of the world doesn't use it. Mm-hmm. They use, it's called the ICD. We're on the 11th version of that. And that's put out by the World Health Organization. And it organizes all diseases, including mental health conditions. And again, we're sort of like, we're still refusing to use the metric system here, right? We're just not.
We do better, right?
Yeah. And so a lot of people are saying the ICD-9. And so questions during the testimony came up about that. And I don't know that that was very well explained.
Yeah, that's what Reddington's been really hammering on that as well, I thought, every time he's been across.
He knows. He has been very educated on this stuff. Well, and I just want people to really know that the DSM is fuzzy. And if you get a room of six clinicians and they're looking at a complex case like this one, and they're trying to come up through the DSM, well, which category fits best? There's a lot of overlapping symptoms between the categories, and you may get six different opinions, and then everybody argues about it until they can come up with a consensus. So diagnosis is complicated, but it's so important that it be done well, because treatment plan is dependent on diagnosis. And we can see early on, when she was diagnosed with just generalized anxiety disorder, the treatment plan was inadequate and it did not serve her, which is ultimately how we got into this mess.
And we're seeing in this, it's I think it's a segue for me to introduce this a little bit as well. You know, when my team was operating, the things we did was very similar to this, and that is I had a specific function that I was doing for a case in operation. We need to assess a human being, what was going on in their lives, and how we were going to have a healthy interaction with them, whatever our objective was. What my team would do is we'd have people like me, which are the behavioral analysts and experts on human behavior at the practical field level, like interacting with human beings. We would come up with our observations, our points to consider, and the things that I've been talking about here with these life arcs. And then I'd have an operational psychologist with us. We'd have either Dr. Reed Malloy, we'd have Dr. Chris Mahandy, and as we just saw on the stand, Dr. Greg Satoff was also one of the people on my team. And each one of these clinicians had specific skill sets for specific things. And I knew what each one of these specific skill sets were. And I would hand pick the ones I needed, not for confirmation bias, but because they had a specific skill set with a specific tool, technique, or human being that they're interacting with. Like, I've had multiple cases where I needed a hardcore clinician that could manage some people that are actually, we knew, were kind of falling off the rails from the behavioral observation. So I brought in Dr. Reed Malloy. Mm-hmm. Hands down, a great guy for that. And then when it came to operational specifics, like we were doing some high tempo operations and people are going to be under a lot of stress, they've been through a lot of stress, I brought in my operational guy, which was Dr. Chris Mahandy. I mean, so I had these people. And then when I needed a psychiatrist with medical expertise, who had actually dealt with medications, things like that, I had Greg Satoff. So all these people fit a specific role that was very specific. And what we're seeing in this case, as presented by the prosecution, is it looks like they're throwing a shotgun at it. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. Let's try this. And that's why we're seeing all over the board.
So why on earth did we end up with Greg Satoff on the stand? I mean, I guess that's my question, because he's an expert in certain areas without a doubt. I'm not trying to discredit or play him down at all, but it feels like, this is my conjecture, the prosecution has brought a lot of people as experts in certain areas, just not this one.
Yes.
And are trying to, like, present them as an expert in this area because they're experts over here, so it must kind of bleed over here a little bit, right? Is that because there's just not a lot of true experts on postpartum psychosis because 100%. It is so rare?
Yeah.
So we're, it is, I mean, tell me about that, Siobhan.
Yeah, 100%, because it is rare. Many people have never seen it. There's not, you know, copious amounts of data on it. And I was really struck by the prosecution expert witnesses who had seen it themselves, who didn't understand it themselves. And I thought Reddington did a great job of pointing out their deficiencies in really understanding it.
Yeah, it became very predictable, like when we were texting back and forth with when Dr. Greg Satoff took the stand. And I'll tell you, he has been a clinician a very long time.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen him in many years, and he was phenomenal on our team. Amazing, very well spoken, very well researched. But I was surprised to see him there in that kind of thing. So, because based on my, again, I didn't know his full background when working with him. I just knew it related to us. But I could predict what Reddington was going to do based on what I knew of that and exactly what's happening today, which has happened. It's not just him. It's all of them that actually don't have that expertise, which, as Siobhan just pointed out, it's a very, very rare and specific expertise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. It is. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsay Clancy trial.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.